listeners, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who, like you perhaps, will be a guest at a wedding this month. What is it about June and weddings? The Library of Congress researcher in me could just not resist, so here's some history. June is named after Juno, Roman goddess of marriage, who promises to bring prosperity and happiness to all who wed in her month. Of course, our ancestors had some practical reasons, too. If married in June, the bride was likely to birth her first child in spring, offering her enough time to recover before the fall harvest. And June's warming weather allowed one to remove winter clothes and bathe, an infrequent occurrence in olden days. Okay, that's a bit of history. Now let's proceed down the aisle and on with our literary salute to love and nuptials. Let's turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Lottie just knows her boyfriend is going to propose over lunch at one of London's fanciest restaurants. But when his big question concerns an upcoming trip, and not a trip down the aisle, she's crushed. So begins Sophie Kinsella's new romp, Wedding Night. When old flame Ben calls Lottie out of the blue and reminds her of their pact to marry if they're both still single at 30, she jumps at the chance. In no time at all, they're off for honeymoon on a Greek isle where they met years ago. Friends and family are horrified. Fliss, Lottie's older sister, knows Lottie is impulsive and plots to save her. Ben's colleague Lorkin fears the hasty marriage will ruin his friend's career. An elaborate scheme of wedding night sabotage is set in place, and we're off on a honeymoon to remember, for better or worse. An ensemble cast performs the book.
I've bought him an engagement ring. Was that a mistake? I mean, it's not a girly ring. It's a plain band with a tiny diamond in it, which the guy in the shop talked me into. If Richard doesn't like the diamond, he can always turn it round. Or not wear it at all. Keep it on his nightstand, or in a box, or whatever. Or I could take it back and never mention it. Actually, I'm losing confidence in this ring by the minute, but I just felt bad that he wouldn't have anything. Men don't get the greatest deal out of a proposal. They have to set up the occasion, they have to get down on one knee, they have to ask the question, and they have to buy a ring. And what do we have to do? Say yes? Or no, obviously. I wonder what proportion of marriage proposals end in a yes, and what proportion end in a no. I open my mouth automatically to share this thought with Richard, then hastily close it again. Idiot. Sorry? Richard glances up. Nothing, I beam. Just great menu. I wonder if he's bought a ring already. I don't mind either way. On the one hand, it's fabulously romantic if he has. On the other hand, it's fabulously romantic to choose one together. It's a win-win. I sip my water and smile lovingly at Richard. We're sitting at a corner table overlooking the river. It's a new restaurant on the Strand, just up from the Savoy. All black and white marble and vintage chandeliers and button-back chairs in pale grey. It's elegant, but not showy. The perfect place for a lunchtime proposal. I'm wearing an understated bride-to-be white shirt, a print skirt, and have splashed out on stay-up stockings, just in case we decide to cement the engagement later on. I've never worn stay-up stockings before. But then, I've never been proposed to before. Ooh, maybe he's booked a room at the Savoy. No, Richard's not flash like that. He'd never make a ridiculous out-of-proportion gesture. Nice lunch, yes. Overpriced hotel room? No. Which I respect. He's looking nervous. He's fiddling with his cuffs and checking his phone and swirling the water round in his glass. As he sees me watching him, he smiles too. So? So? It's as though we're speaking in code, skirting around the real issue. I fiddle with my napkin and adjust my chair. This waiting is unbearable. Why doesn't he get it over with? No, I don't mean get it over with. Of course I don't. It's not a vaccination. It's... well, what is it? It's a beginning. A first step. The pair of us embarking on a great adventure together. Because we want to take on life as a team. Because we can't think of anyone else we'd rather share that journey with. Because I love him and he loves me. I'm getting misty-eyed already. This is hopeless. I've been like this for days, ever since I realized what he was driving at. He's quite heavy-handed, Richard. I mean, in a good, lovable way. He's direct and to the point and doesn't play games. Thank God. Nor does he land massive surprises on you out of the blue. On my last birthday, he hinted for ages that his present was going to be a surprise trip, which was ideal because I knew to get down my overnight bag and pack a few things. Although, in the end, he did catch me out, because it wasn't a weekend away, as I'd predicted. It was a train ticket to Stroud, which he had biked to my desk with no warning on my midweek birthday. It turned out he'd secretly arranged with my boss for me to have 2 days off, and when I finally arrived at Stroud, a car whisked me to the most adorable Cotswold cottage, where he was waiting with a fire burning and a sheepskin rug laid out in front of the flames.
We've just heard Wedding Night by Sophie Kinsella. Rhea Elias was born in Aleppo, Syria in 1960. When she was 7, her family fled the political conflict and moved to Detroit. Bullied in school and caught between a traditional family and tough American classmates, she rebelled. Rhea moved to New York City to become a musician and kept herself afloat by cutting hair. At the height of the punk movement, life on the Lower East Side was full of adventure, creative inspiration, and temptation. Rhea's occasional drug use turned to addiction. Harley Loco is the nickname given to her in jail, and it's the title of her memoir that some reviewers describe as a shock and roll autobiography. Joining us for the interview was Rhea's mentor, Elizabeth Gilbert. Elizabeth Gilbert was born in Connecticut in 1969 and grew up on her family's small Christmas tree farm. She attended NYU, studied poli-sci by day, and worked on short stories by night. After college, she spent some years traveling around the country, working in bars, diners, and ranches, collecting experience to transform into fiction. Returning to New York, she worked as a journalist for Spin, GQ, and the New York Times Magazine. She was a 3-time finalist for the National Magazine Award, and a GQ article she wrote about bartending on the Lower East Side became the basis for the movie Coyote Ugly. Of course, Elizabeth is best known for her memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, which sold over 10 million copies and was made into a film starring Julia Roberts. The book became so popular that Time magazine named Elizabeth as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. In 2010, Elizabeth published Committed, a memoir exploring her ambivalence about the institution of marriage. The book immediately became a bestseller, and we'll listen to a sampling today. Her latest novel, The Signature of All Things, a sprawling tale of 19th-century botanical exploration, will be published in 2013. So I'm here with Rhea and Elizabeth, and I want to say welcome to you both, and thank you so much for stopping by the book report. The obvious question is, how did you meet, the two of you?
I'll take that. We met about 13 years ago in New York through a mutual friend. Rhea was doing hair out of her apartment in the East Village, and my friend had just really gotten sick of looking at my Art Garfunkel hair, as she used to describe it. And she said, dude, you have to seriously take care of that. And so she sent me to Rhea, and never could I have imagined that I would meet somebody who would become so important in my life there. And over the years and over the haircuts, we just got closer and closer and closer. And, you know, normally people sit in the hairdresser's chair and it's kind of a confessional booth and you share stories of your own life. But I quickly learned that it was better to listen to her stories because they were more interesting than mine. And I became so fascinated by her strange, twisted, unusual darkness into light tale that I just encouraged her to write a book, and that's been the journey she's been on the last few years, and that's how Harley Loco was born.
All right, and may I say, you have great hair.
Well, guess who did it? Guess who did the color? Guess who did the cut? Guess who just touched it up before we arrived? Come on a normal day and see what you get.
All right.
I still can rock a little Art Garfunkel at times.
Rhea, you've been described as a self-professed art rocker, ex-junkie, glamour butch lesbian, but how would you like to be introduced to people opening Harley Loco to page one?
Glamour butch, art rocker, punk rock, lesbian, survivor, who is so grateful for every moment that she has. Every moment I wake up, I'm like elated.
Your book, Subhead, is a memoir of hard living, hair, and post-punk rock from the Middle East to the Lower East Side. What have reactions been from non-East Coast readers, like people in Omaha, for example?
I've had great, you know, that's the subtitle to it, but the content and the message is so universal. I've had middle-aged women write to me and really connect with the bullying aspect or the food, you know, the eating, the addictive sort of aspect, the family, the moving. I mean, there's been so many connections on so many different levels that, you know, for me, it's shocking because I'm like, how did a middle-aged housewife in Massachusetts or in Wisconsin or whatever connect with this? But I think that there's a message in there, and the message is hope. And that's what I think people are connecting with. It's like, doesn't matter how many times you get knocked down. You know, what matters is that you get up.
And I think also, I mean, your grandparents had to move from Turkey to Syria, and then your whole family with you at a young age had to move from Syria to Detroit. I think there's so much to connect with at that experience.
There's an inability to sort of feel stable at any given moment. So I'm constantly on the go. And, you know, I juggle many different hats, and I really feel like that's part of my heritage. You know, like, we never felt safe. They never felt safe in Turkey. We didn't feel safe in Syria. Royal Oak, then Warren. And then for me, I didn't really feel safe or content in Detroit, and I had to move to New York. And then we all know what happened in New York. So,
right. I wanted to ask you mentioned your home. Your descriptions of some of the apartments that you lived in New York were so grim. Did your family ever visit you in any of them?
They tried. I normally wouldn't let them. There was one time that I do remember, my mother and my sister came up to my Chelsea apartment, and it, you know, the look on their face when they walked in, like, for us, it was just, it's normal. I mean, to live in a little squalor, you know, especially when you had the lifestyle that I had. But the look on my mother's face and my sister's when they walked in and they were staying at the Ritz was just like, you know, and they were like, do our hair. And I was like, I'll bring my kit up to your place because I don't think this is really, you know, up to your standards. So, yeah. They didn't visit very often.
All right. You've been a musician, artist, hairstylist. What made you pick up the pen to write this story?
This one here, Elizabeth Gilbert, she didn't make me, but she encourage me. She, you know, she just said to me, like, look, these stories are worthy of putting down. And I was like, a book? I can't write a book. Like, I write lyrics. I can write a short script. I can, but a book just seemed like such a huge, huge task that there was no way that I thought I could start it and finish it. And what does it take to be a writer? And she said, honey, you just have to sit down and write. And I'm like, really? Like, what a revelation, you know, because I just thought that it took all of this backstory, all of this, like, education or knowing. And what it took was a lot, don't get me wrong, but it just took the experience and the consistency to just sit and almost be dared to do it, because you don't want to dare me to do anything, you know? And it wasn't a dare, but she was just so encouraging. It was like, she's amazing and she believes in me. Maybe I can believe in myself, and I don't want to let her down because she believes in me. 2 weeks after she said, move into the church house and write, I remember writing her an email and I was like, you know, why me? Like, I've never had anybody pick me, you know? And, you know, what she wrote back was just this amazing, like, I see you and I see who you are. And so through her eyes, I was able to start seeing myself.
When you started writing, did you have a writing mentor as wonderful as you?
I had a different trajectory as a writer than Rhea. You know, I've only ever had one path from consciousness on, which was to be a writer of stories and books and novels and whatever, like Words Are Us, whatever needs to be written, I'm on hand to write it. And, you know, probably my biggest writing mentor was my older sister. I grew up in a farmhouse in the country with no neighbors and no TV. And I had this Scheherazade of an older sister who invented these worlds for us. And we lived in our imaginations. And she was very disciplined as a child as well. And she wrote plays for us to act out. And she, you know, and it was all very, very imaginative and specific stuff. Like, it wasn't just that we were time traveling cave kids. We were time traveling cave kids who had polio, you know, like there was always like these really weird specific details. And so I kind of grew up under her imagination. And it was just second nature for me to write my own plays, write my own stories. And that's all I've ever done ever since.
After Eat, Pray, Love, what kind of pressure was there on you to write the next book?
It was a tricky moment. That's how I always describe it. It wasn't, I'm really stubborn about not ever letting anything that happens in my writing life become any kind of a tragedy. I'm really adamant about that. I have a sort of lifetime crusade against German romanticist ideas about tortured artists. I really believe that it's a beautiful life to have chosen, and it's an interesting life to have chosen, and that part of the deal with it is that you roll as gracefully as you can with whatever occurs. And so I felt like the Eat, Pray, Love tsunami was something to be, to try to ride as carefully as I could without letting it jar me too much. And then the really important part was to just keep being a writer afterwards and, you know, recognize that whatever happens to your work after you put it out in the world is none of your business. I tell that to Rhea all the time. You know, you're only responsible for the product. You're not responsible for the response. And everyone is invited to read my books. It's unlikely that 10 million people will ever do it again. I recognize that, you know, and yet I know my calling, so I kind of just put my head down and keep doing it.
All right. Speaking about your next book, the topic is really, really fascinating. How did you get involved? The title is?
The Signature of All Things.
All right. And it's about?
It's about botany.
Okay.
It's a novel. It's my first novel in a dozen years. I got my start as a fiction writer. It's really funny. It's very cute for me when people come up and they say to me about Eat, Pray, Love, I really loved your first book. And I think you don't mean my small, obscure collection of literary short fiction called Pilgrims. I think you're pretty sure what you mean by my first book, but I had books before that, and they were fiction, and I'm going back to that now. So it's a big, giant, historic epic, takes place from 1780 to 1880, and it follows the fortunes of a family of botanical explorers across the world. And it was great adventure to research it and to write it.
Now, you grew up on a Christmas tree farm. Is that kind of where this book might have started from?
My people are people of the dirt. There's no question about it. You know, they're really like wholesome people. They're all planters and growers and gardeners and farmers. And I heartily rejected that as a kid and tried very hard to stay as far away from it as I could and went to New York City as fast as I could get myself there, and now live in a small town exactly like the one my parents lived in, with a giant garden and a desire to get goats and chickens. So I'm sort of coming back to the fold. But yeah, I when I settled down and got my own garden, I realized it was the only thing I was interested in. And that's what led me to want to write about botany.
Huh. And when will that be out?
October 1st, 2013.
I hope you'll come back on the book report to talk about it.
I would love to. Thank you, Elaine.
Rhea, one review of your book likened it to George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London. Wow, what did you think of that?
Well, I mean, to be put in the same sentence as that just, you know, spun me.
What do you think of New York's evolution from when you landed there?
I have had really mixed feelings about it. It has grown and it has evolved with me. When I was down in the dumps, it felt like New York was also sort of in a place of disarray like that. And as sort of I've gotten better and, you know, gone back there to sort of be in the belly of the beast, to get well with the city, I'm really grateful at the things that are happening. I'm grateful that it's cleaned up. I'm grateful that, you know, there's not blown out cars and blown out buildings everywhere. Like, I'm really, yeah, just bring back the junkies and the homeless, because I want, you know, I want my rent to be low. Then I bought an apartment and I was like, wait a minute, I don't want that guy on my stoop. You know, so, I mean, as we grow up, it's, you know, I have a problem with certain parts of gentrification and pushing out the old families. Because I've seen kids grow up in my neighborhood, you know, which are now in their late 20s, you know, when their mothers were toting them around as babies. And their grandparents have been pushed out because they can't afford to live there, and some of them have turned into drug dealers, so they can't afford to live there. So I have really mixed feelings, and yet I think there's a place for everyone in New York. I mean, if everyone that wanted me out, if I left when everyone who looked at me and thought I was the homeless junkie that needed to be thrown out of there, then I wouldn't be there either. So when I look at the yuppies, or I look at the, you know, whoever it is, I think there's a place for everybody in New York, and I love it. I can't imagine not having, it's in my blood, you know, I can't imagine not living there.
Well, we've heard about another new project. What about yours? After this book tour, what's next for you?
I think I'm going to do a video of one of my songs. I'm working on some excerpts, short stories that I'm really, really excited, you know, to do. And I really want to start a podcast called Chicks, Football, Music, and Sex. Because I love football, and there's no girls doing, like, coverage of football. I just think it'd be so much fun.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me today. Your book was wonderful. It was really, reading it was like sitting here and talking to you. I want to congratulate you.
Thanks so much.
And it's certainly an honor to meet you. Thank you so much,
thank
Elizabeth.
You
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Committed, narrated by the author.
Another question people ask me all the time these days is how Eat, Pray, Love has changed my life.
That one is difficult to answer because the scope has been so massive. A useful analogy from my childhood. When I was little, my parents once took me to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. We stood there together in the Hall of Oceans. My dad pointed up toward the ceiling at the life-size model of the great blue whale that hung suspended over our heads. He tried to impress upon me the size of this gargantuan creature, but I could not see the whale. I was standing right beneath the whale, mind you, and I was staring directly up at the whale, but I could not absorb the whale. My mind had no mechanism for comprehending something so large. All I could see was the blue ceiling and the wonderment on everyone else's faces. Obviously, something exciting was happening here, but I could not grasp the whale itself. That's how I feel sometimes about Eat, Pray, Love. There came a point in that book's trajectory where I could no longer sanely absorb its dimensions, so I gave up trying and turned my attention to other pursuits. Planting a garden helped. There's nothing like picking slugs off your tomato plants to keep things in perspective. That said, it has been a bit of a perplexity for me to figure out how, after that phenomenon, I would ever write unselfconsciously again. Not to act all falsely nostalgic for literary obscurity, but in the past I had always written my books in the belief that very few people would read them. For the most part, of course, that knowledge had always been depressing. In one critical way, though, it was comforting. If I humiliated myself too atrociously, at least there wouldn't be many witnesses. Either way, the question was now academic. I suddenly had millions of readers awaiting my next project. How in the world does one go about writing a book that will satisfy millions? I didn't want to blatantly pander, but I also didn't want to dismiss out of hand all those bright, passionate, and predominantly female readers, not after everything we'd been through together. Uncertain of how to proceed, I proceeded anyhow. Over the course of a year, I wrote an entire first draft of this very book, 500 pages, but I realized immediately upon completion that it was somehow wrong. The voice didn't sound like me. The voice didn't sound like anybody. The voice sounded like something coming through a megaphone, mistranslated. I put that manuscript away, never to be looked at again, and headed back out to the garden for some more contemplative digging, poking, and pondering. I want to make it clear here that this was not exactly a crisis, that period when I could not figure out how to write, or at least when I could not figure out how to write naturally. Life was really nice otherwise, and I was grateful enough for personal contentment and professional success that I wasn't about to manufacture a calamity from this particular puzzle. But it certainly was a puzzle. I even started wondering if maybe I was finished as a writer. Not being a writer anymore didn't seem like the worst fate in the world, if indeed that were to be my fate, but I honestly couldn't tell yet. I had to spend a lot more hours in the tomato patch, is all I'm saying, before I could sort this thing out. In the end, I found a certain comfort in recognizing that I could not, cannot, write a book that would satisfy millions of readers, not deliberately anyhow. The fact is, I do not know how to write a beloved bestseller on demand. If I knew how to write beloved bestsellers on demand, I can assure you that I would have been writing them all along because it would have made my life a lot easier and more comfortable ages ago. But it doesn't work that way, or at least not for writers like me. We write only the books that we need to write or are able to write, and then we must release them, recognizing that whatever happens to them next is somehow none of our business. For a multitude of personal reasons, then, the book that I needed to write was exactly this book. Another memoir, with extra socio-historical bonus sections, about my efforts to make peace with the complicated institution of marriage. The subject matter was never in doubt, it's just that I had trouble there for a while finding my voice. Ultimately, I discovered that the only way I could write again at all was to vastly limit, at least in my own imagination, the number of people I was writing for. So, I started completely over, and I did not write this version of Committed for millions of readers. Instead, I wrote it for exactly 26 readers.
We've just heard Committed by Elizabeth Gilbert. The Book Report brings you a title that's been incredibly popular with book clubs this summer, Me Before You by Jojo Moyes. Louisa Clark is an ordinary girl living an ordinary life, with a steady boyfriend and a close family. Though she's never traveled much beyond her small town, she decides to take a badly needed job working for Will Traynor, who was tragically wheelchair-bound after an accident. Will had always lived a huge life, big deals, extreme sports, worldwide travel. But now, he's acerbic, moody, bossy. But Lou refuses to treat him with kid gloves. Soon, his happiness means more to her than she expected. When she learns of a shocking plan of Will's, she sets out to show him life is still worth living. Susan Lyon narrates.
There are 158 footsteps between the bus stop and home. But it can stretch to 180 if you aren't in a hurry, like maybe if you're wearing platform shoes. I turned the corner onto our street, 68 steps, and could just see the house, a four-bedroom semi in a row of other three- and four-bedroom semis. Dad's car was outside, which meant he hadn't yet left for work. Behind me, the sun was setting behind Stortfold Castle, its dark shadow sliding down the hill like melting wax to overtake me. On a different sort of day, I could have told you all the things that had happened to me on this route. Where Dad taught me to ride a bike without stabilizers, where Mrs. Doherty with the lopsided wig used to make us Welsh cakes, the hedge where Trina knocked a wasp's nest and we ran screaming all the way back to the castle. Thomas's tricycle was upturned on the path, and, closing the gate behind me, I dragged it under the porch and opened the door. The warmth hit me with the force of an airbag. Mum is a martyr to the cold, and keeps the heating on all year round. Dad is always opening windows, complaining that she'd bankrupt the lot of us. He says our heating bills are larger than the GDP of a small African country.
That you, love?
Yep. I hung my jacket on the peg, where it fought for space among the others.
Which you? Lou? Trina?
Lou. I peered around the living room door. Dad was face down on the sofa, his arm thrust deep between the cushions as if they'd swallowed his limb whole. Thomas, my 5-year-old nephew, was on his haunches, watching him intently.
Lego.
Dad turned his face toward me, puce from exertion. Why they have to make the damn pieces so small, I don't know. Where's Mum?
Upstairs.
How about that? A 2-pound piece. I looked up, just able to hear the familiar creak of the ironing board. Josie Clark, my mother, never sat down. It was a point of honour. She'd been known to stand on an outside ladder painting the windows, occasionally pausing to wave while the rest of us ate a roast dinner.
Will you have a go at finding this bloody arm for me? He's had me looking for half an hour and I've got to get ready for work.
Are you on nights?
Yeah. It's 5:30.
I glanced at the clock. Actually, it's 4:30. He extracted his arm from the cushions and squinted at his watch.
Then what are you doing home so early?
I shook my head vaguely, as if I might have misunderstood the question, and walked into the kitchen. Granddad was sitting in his chair by the kitchen window, studying a Sudoku. The health visitor had told us it would be good for his concentration, help his focus after the strokes. I suspected I was the only one to notice he simply filled out all the boxes with whatever number came to mind.
Hey, Grandad.
He looked up and smiled.
You want a cup of tea?
He shook his head and partially opened his mouth.
Cold drink?
He nodded. I opened the fridge door. There's no apple juice. Apple juice, I remembered now, was too expensive.
Water?
He nodded, murmured something that could have been a thank you as I handed him the glass. My mother walked into the room, bearing a huge basket of neatly folded laundry.
Are these yours?
She brandished a pair of socks.
Trina's, I think.
I thought so. Odd colour. I think they must have got in with Daddy's plum pyjamas.
You're back early. Are you going somewhere?
No.
That was Me Before You by Jojo Moyes. It is June 1962. In a hotel on the Dorset coast that overlooks Chesil Beach, Edward and Florence, married that morning, are sitting down to dinner in their room. Neither is entirely able to suppress anxieties about the wedding night to come. On Chesil Beach is Ian McEwan's 13th work of fiction. Critics have called it a five-part classical drama rendered in prose. It's a story about how the entire course of a life can be changed by a gesture not made or a word not spoken. The author narrates.
The garden vegetation rose up, sensuous and tropical in its profusion, an effect heightened by the grey soft light and a delicate mist drifting in from the sea, whose steady motion of advance and withdrawal made sounds of gentle thunder, then sudden hissing against the pebbles. Their plan was to change into rough shoes after supper and walk on the shingle between the sea and the lagoon, known as the Fleet. And if they had not finished the wine, they would take that along and swig from the bottle like gentlemen of the road. And they had so many plans, giddy plans, heaped up before them in the misty future, as richly tangled as the summer flora of the Dorset coast, and as beautiful. Where and how they would live, who their close friends would be, his job with her father's firm, her musical career, and what to do with the money her father had given her, and how they would not be like other people, at least not inwardly. This was still the era. It would end later in that famous decade, when to be young was a social encumbrance, a mark of irrelevance, a faintly embarrassing condition for which marriage was the beginning of a cure. Almost strangers, they stood strangely together on a new pinnacle of existence, gleeful that their new status promised to promote them out of their endless youth. Edward and Florence, free at last. One of their favourite topics was their childhoods, not so much the pleasures as the fog of comical misconceptions from which they had emerged, and the various parental errors and outdated practices they could now forgive. From these new heights they could see clearly, but they could not describe to each other certain contradictory feelings. They separately worried about the moment sometime soon after dinner, when their new maturity would be tested, when they would lie down together on the four-poster bed and reveal themselves fully to one another. For over a year, Edward had been mesmerized by the prospect that on the evening of a given date in July, the most sensitive portion of himself would reside, however briefly, within a naturally formed cavity inside this cheerful, pretty, formidably intelligent woman. How this was to be achieved without absurdity or disappointment troubled him. His specific worry, based on one unfortunate experience, was of overexcitement, of what he had heard someone describe as arriving too soon. The matter was rarely out of his thoughts, but though his fear of failure was great, his eagerness for rapture, for resolution, was far greater. Florence's anxieties were more serious, and there were moments during the journey from Oxford when she thought she was about to draw on all her courage to speak her mind. But what troubled her was unutterable, and she could barely frame it for herself. Where he merely suffered conventional first-night nerves, she experienced a visceral dread, a helpless disgust as palpable as seasickness. For much of the time, through all the months of merry wedding preparation, she managed to ignore this stain on her happiness. But whenever her thoughts turned towards a close embrace, she preferred no other term, her stomach tightened dryly. She was nauseous at the back of her throat.
We've just heard On Chesil Beach by Ian McEwan. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Wedding Cake Mystery Series by Mary Jane Clark is a delectable concoction and a great summer read. Footprints in the Sand, Book 3, finds struggling actress and wedding cake decorator Piper Donovan in Sarasota, Florida, enjoying the powdery white beaches and golden sunsets over the Gulf of Mexico. She and her family are there to celebrate her cousin's wedding. Not only is Piper creating the wedding cake, she's also the maid of honor. But a cloud hovers over the affair. Shortly after a bridesmaid mysteriously disappears, a neighbor's car is run off the road, and an innocent witness is threatened to keep silent. Then a body is found on the wedding beach. With the nuptials threatened, it falls to Piper to unmask a killer. Does the wedding planner have something to hide? Could it be the best man? And what about the bridegroom? Therese Plummer narrates.
Green and yellow birds chirp noisily in the palm trees outside the terminal at Sarasota Bradenton International Airport. The sky was clear and bright, but the breeze was cool as Piper Donovan and her parents pulled their luggage across the macadam. Not exactly beach weather, observed Piper, but it's so much better than that frigid nightmare we left behind in New Jersey. Terry smiled at her daughter. Look at that sky, she said, gazing upward. Did you ever see a more beautiful blue? And hardly a cloud in it.
That's what you say every time we come down here, Terry,
Vin remarked as his eyes scanned the parking lot, searching for the rental car. I know I do, said Terry. That's because I can't ever get over how pretty it is. Heaven! Nora and Frank sure had the right idea when they moved down here. Too bad Uncle Frank didn't live long enough to really enjoy it, said Piper, as she rested the small box she was carrying on top of the car. She reached for her parents' bags and hoisted them into the trunk. I miss him. Me too, sweetheart, said Terry, as she thought of her older brother. I wish he were still here, especially now. Frank should be walking his daughter down the aisle. Vin reached out, put his arm around his wife's shoulder, and drew her close.
Don't worry. I'm going to do the best I can to stand in for him, he said, kissing her on the forehead. Even though there really isn't any aisle to walk down. Whatever happened to a church with a priest? Now put on your sunglasses, Terry. You know the bright light bothers your eyes.
This macular degeneration is such a drag, said Terry as she opened her purse. While her mother searched for the glasses, Piper struggled to make the last bag fit. Vin scowled as he watched.
Here, let me do it, he said, reaching into the trunk.
I can do it, Dad.
No, I'll do it.
Piper stood back, knowing that letting her father have his way was easier than resisting. After Vin had neatly rearranged the trunk's contents, Piper took the small box from the roof, holding it carefully as they all got into the sedan and buckled themselves into their seats. I'm glad Nora has finally met someone, said Terry as she settled back. She's been by herself for too long. What's his name again? Asked Piper, pulling a clip from the pocket of her hoodie and sweeping her long blonde hair up into a loose bun. Walter. Walter Engel. And what's his deal? He's a businessman, answered Terry. I gather he's into a lot of things. I know he owns the Whispering Sands Inn. The car pulled out of the parking lot, exited the airport property, and turned left on the Tamiami Trail. All the passengers knew exactly where they were heading. My mouth is literally salivating for that pie already, said Piper, closing her eyes and resting her head on the rear seat. The direct flight from New York to Sarasota left early in the morning, which meant rising well before dawn. The food on the plane had been next to non-existent, leaving them famished. It was their custom on each yearly visit to their Florida relatives to stop first at Fisher's, an Amish restaurant, to get something to eat. The gleaming office buildings and high-rise condominiums that overlook the downtown marina gave way to a stretch of the Tamiami Trail dotted with chain stores and restaurants.
That was Footprints in the Sand by Mary Jane Clark. As comforting as crawling under a favorite quilt, Jennifer Chavarini's heartwarming Elk Creek Quilt series is a favorite with many readers. The Wedding Quilt, Book 18, is a celebration of family and friendship. At the approach of the wedding day of Sarah McClure's daughter, her thoughts are filled with brides of Elk Creek Manor past and present. A wedding quilt is a powerful metaphor, and Sarah is determined the blocks in her daughter's quilt will display a vivid composition of love in all its varieties. Christina Moore narrates.
Her mouth suddenly dry, Sarah washed down the chicken with a gulp of water. James touched her on the back as he rose and went to confer briefly with the president. Conversation faded as he took the podium. Without a pad or notes of any kind, Sarah noted with rueful admiration, and adjusted the microphone. "Good afternoon," he greeted them, his voice confident and cheerful. "Thank you for joining us today as we dedicate Union Hall's newest permanent exhibit, the Agnes Bergstrom Emberley Quilt Gallery." A smattering of applause went up from his listeners. "Some of you had the pleasure of knowing Agnes during her many years as an active member of the Waterford Historical Society, including a 2-year stint as president, a post she assumed soon after she launched the campaign to save this very building. Although Mrs. Emberley was not born in the Elm Creek Valley, as a longtime resident, she cared deeply about the history of our community and was equally passionate about preserving and documenting historically significant but long-forgotten quilts discovered in storage rooms, attics, and boxes underneath beds. It was she who founded the Waterford Historical Society's extensive collection of quilts, a mission that she passed on to our keynote speaker." He spared a proud smile for Sarah. "Although I was just a kid when I knew Mrs. Emberley, I know she would be very pleased with how the collection has grown under Sarah McClure's stewardship." Sarah felt herself flush with pride as applause rang out again, but then her heart thumped and she checked her pad to be sure she had not accidentally deleted her speech. "I'm sure Sarah McClure is well known to all of you as the president and founder of Elm Creek Quilts," James continued, "the world's most respected and renowned quilter's retreat. There, she introduced countless thousands of aspiring quilters to the art and inspired innumerable experienced quilters to more fully develop their creative gifts. Her contributions to the study of quilts and other textiles, including her 3-volume series on the history of quilting from the medieval era through the early 21st century, have rightly earned her awards and accolades. Her latest book, The Quilts of Pennsylvania, is the most thoroughly researched and detailed state quilt documentation project ever undertaken. 10 years in the making, and well worth the wait. And I'm not saying that just because my name appears in the acknowledgments." A ripple of laughter went up from the audience. "This afternoon, our speaker will tell you more about Agnes Bergstrom Emberley, whom she was proud to call a friend and colleague, and in whose memory the Waterford Historical Society has dedicated their newly refurbished East Gallery. When, afterward, you view this magnificent collection of antique quilts, displayed for the first time in its entirety, I hope you'll keep in mind that the collection would not exist if not for the foresight of Mrs. Emberley and the wisdom, tenacity, and generosity of our speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great privilege to introduce to you my mother, Sarah Mallory McClure." Sarah smiled as she rose and took the podium to thunderous applause. "You paused after saying, 'my mother,' for dramatic effect," she teased James afterward as they strolled through the gallery admiring the collection. "You always do." "I had to," said James, feigning innocence. "But not for dramatic effect. Their reaction would have drowned out your name. 160 people simultaneously saying, 'aw,' can get kind of loud." 160?
James nodded.
"I counted."
"You always remember." No wonder her hand was sore. She had signed books for nearly an hour after her speech, about half of them pen upon paper, the other half stylus to pad.
That was The Wedding Quote by Jennifer Chavarini. Suzanne de Rocher's debut novel, Bride of New France, chronicles the tales of the legendary Fille de Roy, the young French women sent to Canada to help populate the new colony. Laure has grown up in a dormitory in Paris, surrounded by prostitutes, the insane, and other forgotten women. Despite numerous hardships, she dreams of using her needlework skills to become a seamstress and one day marry. But in 1669, Laure's dreams are dashed when she's sent across the Atlantic to New France as a fille de roi. Emma Baring performs a remarkable tale of a French girl's struggle to survive in a brutal time and place.
The commotion in the courtyard below reaches Laure when she steps into the Sainte-Claire dormitory. There is only Mireille lying in the long room of tightly made beds when Laure enters with Madeleine. The two girls have been given special permission by the dormitory governess to sit with their sick friend for a few minutes before returning to their needlework lessons. Laure doesn't really believe that Mireille is ill and refuses to show her any sympathy. She knows that Mireille is just trying to get out of her last month in the workshop. Mireille found out last week that she was going to marry an officer stationed in Canada. He is a young and handsome man, and wealthy enough that Mireille will not ever have to return to the Salpêtrière. While Laure has been struggling to learn new Point de France stitches, Mireille has been feigning sickness, the distant soldier's locket tucked under her pillow. Still, Laure is happy to have an excuse to come up to the empty dormitory. With no officers around, she can talk freely without being hushed or told to start reciting the Pater Noster. Madeleine rushes past the window toward Mireille's bed at the end of the room. She has brought with her, in the pocket of her dress, an ounce of salted butter that she saved from lunch. She takes out the melting pad and brings it to Mireille's lips. "Why are you feeding her your lunch? She already gets wine and meat with her pension." Laure can't stand to look at Madeleine fussing over Mireille as if she were a blind kitten in need of milk. How can she be the one getting attention when she already has more than the others? Laure walks to the window and looks down at the dozens of people gathered in the courtyard of the Maison de la Force. They have come today to watch the city's prostitutes being transferred to the Salpêtrière. The girls of the Sainte-Claire dormitory are forbidden to observe these women. Even mentioning them is punishable. The administrators say that observing the prostitutes will taint the morals of the Bijou. They fear that the years of shaping these carefully selected orphans will be lost by one glance at the ill-reputed women. The superior herself has told them that their melodic voices singing Ave Maria Stella and Veni Creator will be spoiled, and that the stitches the Bijou's fingers have been trained to produce in imitation of Venetian lace will unravel in the coarse company of the Fille de Mauvaise Vie. Laure knows she wouldn't be a resident of the Sainte-Claire dormitory at all if it hadn't been for the years she spent being refined in the house of Madame d'Aulnay. Seeing the prostitutes gathered by the archers and the crowd that has come to jeer at them reminds Laure that even the Bijou dormitory of the Salpêtrière, where girls are taught skills, is still a division of the most miserable institution of the kingdom. To those who are not imprisoned within its walls, the Salpêtrière is nothing but a place to lock away the most wretched women of France.
That was Bride of New France by Suzanne de Rocher.
The Saturday Big Tent Wedding Party is the 12th entry from Alexander McCall Smith's best-selling number one ladies detective agency series. If you're unfamiliar with the books, don't wait another minute to discover these delightful tales. Set in Botswana, the story showcases the gentle humanity and matchless wit of Precious Ramotswe, her wonderful colleague Grace Makutsi, and a cast of memorable friends and family. In this installment, though Precious and Grace are puzzled by prophetic dreams, it's business as usual at the number one ladies detective agency. Precious finds herself investigating a case of rural jealousy, while Grace inches closer to her wedding. The wonderful Lisette Lacat narrates.
"I am just a mechanic, Maramotswe," he had said to his wife. "A mechanic is a man who fixes cars and other vehicles. That is what a mechanic does." Maramotswe had listened politely, but her heart within her was a stone of fear. She knew that the fate of her van was at stake, and she would prefer not to know that.
"I think I understand what a mechanic does, Ra," she said. "And you are a very good mechanic, quite capable of fixing it." She didn't finish. The normally mild Mr. JLB Matukoni had raised a finger.
"A mechanic, Ma," he pronounced, "is different from a miracle worker. A miracle worker is a person who works miracles. A mechanic cannot do that, and so, when the time comes for a vehicle to die, and they are mortal, I can assure you, then he cannot wave a wand and make the car new again."
He paused, looking at her with the air of a doctor imparting bad news.
"And so..."
He had done his best for her, of course, and bought her a spanking new van, blue this time, with an array of buttons on the dashboard that she had not yet dared investigate, and with an engine so quiet and unobtrusive that it was sometimes possible to believe that it wasn't switched on at all, and that it was gravity alone, or some other mysterious force that was propelling the van down the road. She tried to appear grateful, but it was hard. It was true that the point of a vehicle was to get you from one place to another without incident, but that, she thought, wasn't the only consideration. If efficiency were the only value in this life, then we would be content to eat bland but nutritious food every day, and the same food at that. That would keep us alive, but it would make for very dull mealtimes. And the same was true of transport. There was all the world of difference between travelling along a highway in an air-conditioned bus behind tinted glass and making the same journey by a side road on a cart pulled by a team of mules, with the morning air fresh against your face and the branches of the acacia trees brushing past so close that you could reach out to touch the delicate green leaves. There was all that difference. The tiny white van had gone to a scrap dealer, and that, she thought, was the end. But then she encountered a woman who told her that a nephew of hers had acquired the van and towed it up to his place near the Tule block. He loved tinkering, she said, and he might be able to do something with the parts that he could strip from the body of the van. That was all Maramotswe heard, and nothing more. It was a better fate, perhaps, than that of total destruction in the jaws of some metal-crushing predator, but still she hoped that the young man who had bought the van for scrap might exercise his mechanical skills and restore it. And that possibility she kept in her mind, tucked away among the other scraps of hope of the sort that we go through life with, not thinking about them very much, but unwilling to let them fade away altogether.
We've just heard The Saturday Big Tent Wedding Party by Alexander McCall Smith. Readers, I do. love bringing you the best new titles worthy of your time. With so many books clamoring for your attention, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for what to read this summer. Thanks for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.